Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for downloading our podcast this week. Our guest is Matthew Gratzner, one of the founders of New Deal Studios, the studio that really specializes in miniature and practical effects, and they've, of course, moved into digital effects more recently. That's kind of a nice tie into the new term over at FXPhD. We just announced on Monday, and we've got 15 brand new courses. That's a record for us. And leading that is actually a stop-frame animation and miniatures course that we're going to be doing. Should be a fantastic course. In addition to that, we've got a DOP course, which is a combination of our popular Red and recent DOP courses. It's going to be taking a look at shooting a low to mid-budget feature with a Red. And in fact, what you can do in that course is you can buy for an additional charge at the end of the term an actual print of the film output of selected scenes, as well as a copy of an SR tape with a graded test. We've got a killer new After Effects course, and I think it's kind of course that could be interesting to anyone. It's going to be a combination of motion graphics design and compositing. Leading that's going to be Mark Christensen, and we've also got Mark Collarin doing the UI graphics. And I'm sure you've seen Collarin's work in feature films. It includes The Bourne Ultimatum, The Island, AVP, and The World Is Not Enough. You know, he's really well-versed in designing feature film UI graphics. We've got a new digital audio post courses. We've got a new Cinema 4D and After Effects design course with Tim Clappin. We've got a new smoke course, a new introduction to flame course, and a ton of other fantastic ones. So be sure to check out fxphd.com for more information about those. Well, back to our subject this week, which is, again, New Deal Studios. Jeff Huser sat down with Matthew Gratzner recently. We spoke with him, actually, if you watch FX Guide TV, you may have seen him as one of our featured speakers in that from the VS Festival Effects last year. But sat down to catch up with them, what they've been working on at New Deal Studios, and what they've got in the works. So let's go ahead and join that conversation now.
Matthew, can you tell us a little history of New Deal Studios?
Well, we started the company with three partners, myself, Shannon Gans, and Ian Hunter. Started the company originally as Hunter Gratzner Industries, which people still sort of know us by that name. And we started as an art direction and miniature effects company. And that was going on 13 years. So it seems like a while, but not too bad. And we developed nothing out of the ordinary in regards to techniques or proprietary technology, but we developed a way of kind of building, designing miniature effects that were within a schedule and within a sort of art department style that could be done relatively quickly for somewhat of a decent price. And more importantly, that really we really tried to focus on making shots not look like effects. Our thrust when we started the company was to develop shots that felt like you were just watching part of the film. Effects nowadays, unfortunately, tend to sometimes be standalone. And our goal was always to develop more storytelling tools that were part of, happened to be visual effects, that were not so effectsy looking, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, we developed the company as a production company. We started out, even though we did miniature effects as well as the art direction, we really wanted to start making our own films, but we knew getting into it from that route would take a little bit of a long process. So we had this sort of huge business plan, which most in film don't seem to have, but we sort of had a relatively long-term business plan. Our partner Shannon is unbelievable with business and dealing with operations, and so she set up kind of an idea of a longer business plan with Ian and I, where we would start with miniature effects, move on to photographic effects, then do digital work, and then start developing our own material. So similar to sort of a Japanese business model for an automaker, it was this very long term. We didn't really necessarily have years dedicated, but we didn't say, oh, this is our 10 or 20 year plan. But we're sort of at the end now of developing our own material. About six and a half years ago, we bought out a company called the Chandler Group, which was a visual effects facility that did primarily photographic effects. And we still work with one of the owners quite often, Tim Angulo, who's a fantastic director of photography. And we took over the company and then decided to change the name from Hunter Gratzner Industries to New Deal Studios. It was a little bit more generic. It didn't have our names attached to it. And we also rent our stage out to a lot of people. So it was just better to have kind of a blanketed blanketed name for it. And then about 3 years ago, we started a department that does digital effects, primarily compositing and animation and tracking and previs. And now we're able to deliver finished shots, essentially, and that's what we've been doing the last few years, which is great. We still have the ability to be flexible enough that if somebody has already had brought on a digital vendor for the show and says, well, we're already having so-and-so do all the compositing, all the animation, can you just build and shoot the elements for us? We'll still do that because, you know, you have to be flexible. You can't do an all-or-nothing business model. It doesn't really work.
Right. This area that you're located in is very historic in terms of visual effects. Shannon was giving me the tour before we started this and explaining kind of the history of some of the area.
This is, it's funny because people think Hollywood and visual effects, they think of maybe the Valley or, you know, the Warner Brothers studio or, you know, Paramount or some of the areas in West Hollywood or Burbank. But funny enough, in the Marina del Rey area, this area just where we are, at the end of the street used to be Boss Film, of course, Richard Edlund's company that did fantastic work. They did Ghostbusters in 2010 and you know, tons and tons of movies. Behind us, Douglas Trumbull had set up his facility to do Blade Runner, and they photographed Close Encounters of the Third Kind. At one time, there was the company ShowScan, which used to be where Chandler Group was, which is where sort of we are now, and that was the concept of shooting. It was a ride film. It was mostly for sort of showcase work of the trick was to shoot material at 60 frames a second and project it at 60 frames a second. So
yeah,
you got this
Universal, like these.
Yeah, you get this razor sharp crisp. It almost looks, it's like is good as like super HD. I mean, it's fantastic, but very expensive because you're shooting. You know, you're burning through a lot of film, and it didn't. I don't know. I don't want to say it didn't take off. I don't know if it's still in the marketplace, but it was fantastic. It was a great concept. So it's sort of a lot of visual effects companies from the late 70s, early 80s were throughout this area, in a very small, within like a three-block radius. It's kind of
right.
Funny.
It's kind of funny now because you've kind of gotten surrounded. This area used to be very industrial. Now it's like condo city.
Yeah, now it's condo city. Our neighbors are thrilled that we're probably going to be blowing things up at 10 o'clock at night. So, but it is an industrial area still. It's a mixed-use area, so you've got residential and industrial and unfortunately, fortunately, I should say, for them, that if it was strictly residential, they couldn't build the condo building. So it's kind of a win-win in some, or win-lose, I guess.
Interesting. So looking through the list of things on the website, I mean, feature films, music videos, television, commercials, theme parks, a lot of design as well, being involved early in the project.
Yeah, one of the things, Ian and I do quite a bit of the concept art here and a lot of the conceptual design. And what happens in most visual effects, or I should say within most visual effects for film, is the art department doesn't tend to necessarily have the time, particularly now with very short pre-production schedules, they don't have the time to do a lot of the design work. And you'll find that visual effects companies are sometimes, whether it's because they can do it or they're kind of stuck doing it, they'll do a lot of the art direction on films regarding the effects. And because Ian and I also do a lot of first-unit, large-scale sets and set pieces and props, we tend to really work closely with the production designers on a show. They may not have the time to generate the artwork, but we'll always make sure it's within keeping of their first-unit vision. Because for us, again, effects should never feel like it's a standalone thing. It should always feel like it's part of an extension of the story, and it's just something that happens to be happening to the characters in the story. It's just a rule of thumb we've always applied, and when it comes to the art direction and design, it's the same thing. When you cut to a shot or you transition from a shot from first unit to one of the effect shot, whether it's miniature, digital, or even a practical effects photography sequence, you should never know there's a change. You should feel like it's all one consistent, continuous shot. And that's something that we always have strived to do because, you know, you never want people to know what part of the film you had been involved with. They should say, I don't know what you did on it, but it looked great.
Sure.
It usually is the best.
Well, especially nowadays when you can have a sequence that can be from practical to digital to set extensions to digital sets to wire work to, you know, everything. It's all mixed.
So exactly.
It's very important.
Very much so.
Cool. So people that may not be familiar, by the way, your website has a lot of good information, a lot of good visuals and historical stills and stuff. I really enjoyed going through that. But just to mention some current features that I noticed on there, like Iron Man, Batman, The Dark Knight, Hancock, Hulk, Starship Dave. So Tropic Thunder, The Shine of Light, the Rolling Stones piece, involved with a lot of...
We do a lot of projects that are, because we're so varied in what we do, we don't just do effects. We'll also do a lot of insert photography. We do a lot of actual first unit photography as well. We've done a number of additional scenes for films. we've tried to diversify enough to keep the company going, because if you just do one thing, it's hard to keep afloat and pay the bills. But more importantly, the diversity for us really gives us the ability to have any tool at hand to do the show. If we're working on a show like Iron Man, for instance, we built a number of miniatures for that. But not only did we have the ability to build the models, we could also then go ahead and shoot. There was tons of insert work they needed that not only played with the models, but played with first unit. So we had the ability to shoot, you know, actor insert work, whether it's the principal talent or doubles or, you know, costume set pieces, whatever it takes, just anything that we can do to help push the film along and give the filmmakers as well as the studio the comfort in knowing that they can bring us a project and we can handle a lot of aspects of it, not just the effects.
Right. And then going back historical, I mean, there's been some amazing films that you've been involved with, and one of the things I really wanted to ask you about was the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the Venice Canals. Those images on the webpage are, and we'll put some, I'm sure we'll go get some of those and put them with the story.
Oh, yeah, anything you need.
That was extraordinary.
League was an interesting project because we didn't have – the pre-production was not terribly huge. And the director had a very specific vision, which he wanted – because we had so much of the city to build as a miniature, he had an idea of making it much bigger and much more colossal than what was in the than live-action sets. And I, funny enough, this was one of the one shows I never interacted with the art department. They were shooting everything in Prague. I never met the production designer. I never met anybody from the art department. And it was kind of an odd thing because usually we're very, very much hand-in-hand. But the director and everyone on the picture was out on the other side of the world trying to get the film done in the dead of winter. It was pretty terrible conditions, so I heard, because I fortunately didn't have to go. But we needed to do construction prior to them finishing the first unit of photography. So the design work on it was sort of left up to me, and the direction from the director was, I want something scary and cool and tall. Go do it. And I mean, literally, that I sent them a concept sketch, and it was done. It's sort of more a concept color drawing, and he liked it, but he felt that it wasn't claustrophobic enough, and it was just a shot of the canal with a sort of a canal bridge in the foreground. He said, no, make it more scary, more claustrophobic. And so I did a quick pencil sketch in a few hours, sent it to him, and the response was, that's great, I love it, rock on. And that was where we started with. There was literally two concept drawings to do the entire city. And then from there, the miniature effects crew chief, Forrest Fisher, started immediately drafting CAD drawings. This was sort of early in our computer design phase. We used to do everything by hand on vellum years and years ago, and we started to get into two-dimensional CAD work. Now, of course, we do everything in 3D. In fact, there's not one miniature we build in here that's not modeled 3D first to make sure it all interacts with our digital department and everything else. But at any rate, so we did the two concept drawings, and then I was at the drafting board drawing window case. I mean, everything by hand. I look back and think, what was I thinking? That's insane. But window casements and window, you know, moldings and bridge work and building facades, while Forrest was sitting there drawing all of this up as construction drawings so we can build everything. But the set was pretty colossal. It was actually, I have to say, while the film didn't get the most favorable reviews, I would say out of all the work I've ever done, as miniature effects go and design work, I'm probably more proud of the design and the physical construction of that, because we ended up building a set that was about 180 feet long. It was about 26 to 30 feet tall, practical canals. We built about 30 buildings in fifth scale. So the whole thing was colossal, and it all had to collapse. It was a number of the buildings were rigged to custom fabricated hydraulic scissor jacks that would sink the buildings. But unfortunately, in the film, it you don't see a lot of it, and not as much as what we built. That's why we put a lot of the pictures on the website, because we probably built more than was ever seen. But there were a number of really big in-camera effects. The shot of the car jumping, for instance, a lot of the car work you see in the film, which racing down between the buildings or skidding around a corner and coming up on the one half of the wheels. It's a six-wheeled car, so it's three wheels on one side. All that was done as an in-camera miniature effect. And for the car skidding around the corner, the only thing they did, I think, in post, as far as I know, is there was a wire that helped assist the elevating of the car that was painted out. But for the most part, it was all in camera. But the shot of the car jumping off the bridge, the only part of that shot that's a... that I think was done in post or dealt with in post is they put it in the sky above the buildings. But other than that, everything you see, it was about a 60-foot launch. And so the car, the bridge, the buildings, everything's in camera. And everybody asked me, well, what part of that, how did you shoot the car as an element? I said, no, it's all there. Scott Beverly is our mechanical effects supervisor, and he built a pneumatic slingshot, essentially. It was sort of like a steam-powered slingshot. You launch a jet off an airplane, aircraft carrier. It was the same kind of gag, and we could launch this car 60 to 80 feet off of this, you know, big pneumatic ram, and it looked fantastic. It worked really well. But yeah, it was a really rewarding show for the design aspects, and again, some of the in-camera work was cool.
That's great. Commercial-wise, one of the reasons we came to talk to you was the Halo 3 thing, and actually it was very funny when I was looking through your commercial credits on the website. I found the Chrysler Carousel, which actually I did. We never met. I never knew you guys did it.
Oh, I'll be darned.
But I did that.
So you worked with David Dreyer. David Dreyer, of course.
Yeah,
sure.
I think I was at the Post Group then. And
that was a fun job. It was a crazy job. The Chrysler, the Carousel, we had something like 3.5 weeks to build that. And it was insane because all the cars had to work. Everything you see working, it did. It was a 12.5 foot in diameter working carousel with something like 900 lights. It all had to be sequenced. It was a nightmare, but it worked out really well. The guys did a great job on it, but it was tough. It was a very tough. Nowadays, that'd just be CG. Which is funny because I look at those sorts of things. I'm like, wow. I look back at some of the things we've done and I think, wow, that would just be animated. Would it necessarily be better? I mean, some of the texturing that I've seen people do are pretty spectacular, but commercial like that, it would probably make sense to do it in CG.
Yeah. But it was amazing for the time. I mean, it was funny. Really
I didn't
cool.
realize.
Yeah, I didn't either. My wife was with me, and I just clicked on. I was like, wait a minute, I really know that spot.
That was and it had to be broken down, put on a truck, and reassembled.
So. Oh boy, yeah, impressive though. The Halo 3 commercial. So that was a VES award winner and huge. Yeah. I saw it on TV. It definitely caught your attention when you first saw it.
That was a really really fun project. We had very little time, but I felt we had enough time. The director of the TV spot was a gentleman by the name of Rupert Sanders, really, really nice guy, very, very talented. The design, McCann Erickson in San Francisco put together this whole concept that they wanted this museum diorama, essentially, that you would see in a museum, assuming that the figures were, let's say, 24 scale, maybe 3 inches tall, or maybe 36 or 35th scale, a little smaller. But the idea was to get the look of a museum diorama, whether it was a World War II battle and the Battle of the Bulge or Battle of Waterloo or something, but instead of being a historic battle that we would know from this Earth, it was Halo, and it was the video game done as a diorama. So the challenge was to come up with a scale that was big enough to photograph and small enough to do really a relatively decent scale to be built in within the time frame and the cost. The tough part was the commercial really had, there was so much to shoot on that model. There were sort of two phases to it. The first phase was the television commercial, and that was a number of spots. And then there was a company called AKQA, who's a website company that did the Halo website, and they had come to us to actually produce and direct the photography for that. So it was kind of two different spots. The Rupert commercial is mostly featuring more of the humanistic aspects of the video game, a lot of tight shots. The figures were beautifully done by Stan Winston Studios, which I have to plug. Alan Scott ran that job, and I have to plug it because they did like 900 figures in something like 2.5 weeks.
Wow.
The television commercial, you don't really see how much there is to it. It was huge. It was a 30 by 40 foot landscape, and we had buildings and every vehicle involved in the Halo world built and designed to be in this one. Ended up being 1/12 scale. The figures ended up being about 6 inches tall. So in the television commercial, it was mostly about the sort of the moments before battle, during battle, the strife and stress and everything that a soldier would go through. But for the website, they really wanted to show off the model itself. So we ended up taking two motion control rigs left and right of the model and doing fly-throughs and hookups in the middle of the rig from one rig to the other because the model was so wide I couldn't get all the way across. So I had to design a move. The requirements from the website company was we need to just be able to go all over the model and essentially show 5 different points that we could then zoom in on and do 360s. And we had we had 2 days to do all the photography, which was insane. And I said, well, we'll just do like a big helicopter over this. And I said, well, it's a video game. It's a first-person shooter video game. Why don't we do that? And I said, well, can you do that? I said, well, that's what we do. So I kind of blocked out a move and showed them what I think we could do with it. And we had, you know, relatively wide-angle lenses on, you know, periscope lenses down low. And we essentially just fly through the model. And they were thrilled because we were able to give the scope and scale of the model, which, while you can sort of get it in bits and pieces in the television commercial, unfortunately, only had, you know, 30 seconds to tell your story. The website was designed so the user could actually scrub through the move. So that way, and if you go to the website, you can actually go through and stop at any point. You can use sections of the model as wallpaper. Pretty cool. They did a fantastic job on the website. I was very pleased with it. But at any rate, because we had the ability to fly through it, I really took advantage of every square inch of that model. And it worked out really well. It was a lot of fun. And the big gimmick, which a lot of people don't understand, and even though they may see the making ofs and think maybe it's been faked, is that everything you see in the commercials and the website, except for the sky backing, was in camera. The explosions, the dust hits, the vehicles, the people, nothing's been composited. It's all in camera. So the big fiery explosions are actually sculpted, translucent, backlit explosions. They're not, everybody thought, oh, they're just photographs of explosions. So that was one of the challenges. When I first talked to the director, he said, well, it'd be great to have like this sort of big dust cloud exploding, but I don't know how we're going to do it. I don't know if it's like cotton or some sort of, you know, diorama type, you know, thing. I said, I got a number of ideas for that. And I said, well, we should definitely try to do a fireball. He said, how do you think it's going to look real? Is it going to look really hokey? I said, well, let me do a test. And I had some ideas. So we put together this really simple prototype and photographed a still, and just from the digital still, looking at the back of the screen, I remember we were laughing because it looked so real. It looked just like a propane explosion caught in mid explosion, and we ended up using taking molds off of cauliflower because we thought that had a good texture, and that's what we ended up doing: making plaster bucks and then vacuum forming clear shells, gluing them together and caulking them and detailing them, and then doing layers and layers of airbrush work to get that sort of fiery look, and then just having lights in them. I mean, it was, when you look at how insanely simple it was, you're like, well, that's not that clever. But on film and on digital stills, it really, really sold. It really worked well. The figures were very, very beautifully done as well. Stan Winston ended up scanning a number of actors and a number of, I think some of the agency and production people ended up being in it too, but they did 3D scans, laser scans of their faces and heads, and then ended up doing three-dimensional grows, you know, wax prototypes and as well as resin pieces. And then those were molded and cast. So some of the heads are actually people from, I think Rupert is actually in the commercial as one of the guys crying, if I'm not mistaken. But a very, very, very well done. They did an unbelievable job over there. And then we had the ability to take some of the models, like the Warthog, for instance, little Jeep-like Humvee that they had. That was done as a 3D model in-house. And then we had it grown as a 3D part out of foam, and then, you know, hand-built that from the different foam patterns. But then the Scorpion tank, one of our model makers, a guy by the name of Greg Betcher, ended up building. That was all scratch-built. It wasn't, even though we had the computer models, it was just more cost-effective within the time frame to hand-build these patterns and then just vacuum-form the whole thing. But it was fun. It was actually, everybody on the job had a great time because 90% of the guys were Halo, you know, players. Right. So that was a big thing. But it was fun. It was a good time.
That's great. Now, congratulations on all the awards and stuff on that.
Oh, it
really was a great spot.
It was really, really cool.
Very cool. How about just thinking back? You've got such a wide resume of projects. Can you think of a couple of favorites?
I would have to say my all-time favorite film that I've ever worked on, not just because the process was great and the people were great, but the outcome of the film was great, was The Aviator for me. Just because we work on a lot of these films. Ian and I always call them the man films: Spider-Man, Batman, X-Men, you know, Watchmen, which is another one we're working on right now or finishing up. And those are great. They're fun to work on. The clients are great. It's really exciting. It's all, you know, huge suspension of disbelief type films. I mean, it's really cool. But there's a sense that, you know, it's effects because it's, you know, obviously you don't have some... A real crane is not crashing through a real building, and Spider-Man, there's no such thing as a Spider-Man. And, you know, so it's not necessarily that the films aren't rewarding. They are, but there's a level of people have a certain expectation going into them. A film like The Aviator is a show where the effects cannot look like effects, because if they do, then you lose the audience. You know, Martin Scorsese is not somebody who's going to be known as an effects director. He's someone who's going to be directing and producing films that are character-driven stories, that without that ability to tell the story, with the ability of telling a story and then getting clouded by visual effects, you take the person out of the story. So The Aviator was really, really, really a great experience. The visual effects supervisor on it, as well as second unit director, is Rob Legato, who's, of course, you know, won tons of awards, and he's a really, really great guy, and I've worked with him for years. But working with Rob, he has a concept of how he wants to do it. He lays it out, but he lets people do their jobs too, which is something that he's not the type of person who's going to sit in there and micromanage everything you do. So Aviator was a great experience because he's sitting there directing second unit, and actually he did a bit of the first unit as well. He's doing these really elaborate previses and planning the stuff out before we end up having to finish construction and shoot, which is great. The crash sequence in Aviator, for instance, shot for shot, what was previs is what's in the film. I mean, it wasn't one of these things where we'll just shoot a bunch of stuff and see how it goes. It really was blocked out. Rob's an excellent editor, so putting together the editing skills and the fact that he's a filmmaker, not just an effects guy, really visually tells the story prior to shooting a frame or building even a piece of the model. So in that sense, because everybody always reacts to the crash sequences, oh, it was so real, it was so believable. And funny enough, if you watch it, there's not one camera move in there that's really that excessive or that dramatic. We didn't use there is a shot with spider cam that there's a point of view flying towards the house before he crashes. But the actual crash itself was shot with cameras on sticks, cameras mounted to sections of the model. Very limited camera move. It's not a lot of stuff, but it's the approach was to feel as if it was a photojournalist sitting there just capturing it happening. But because editorially the story was so well blocked out, by the time and because we're shooting, you know, miniatures that are photoreal because they are photographically real, you with real fire and interaction and pieces flying off the plane, you believe you think you've just seen a real plane crash. And the funny thing about that sequence that I always really enjoy, not only is that every shot in there except for two is an in-camera shot. There's very little post-augmentation. In fact, there's a number of shots that are 100% in-camera, what we photographed with what you see in the movie. And the crash sequence, particularly because we shot it at a golf course, the Balboa Golf Course, we had miniature trees, but then all the real trees in the background kind of blended in as an in-camera approach. What's great about that is it's a pretty raw sequence. There's a couple shots in it where you actually see stuff hit the mat box, and the mat box kind of comes into frame. And Rob left all that in because he's like, well, no, it just feels like you were there shooting it, and this sort of stuff would happen. And that, I think that's one of the reasons why people reacted so well to it. But primarily, it's because it was just well-planned. Right. Every effect sequence that we've ever been involved with where we have the ability to really block it out ahead of time and really just noodle it, whether it's in storyboard form or previs form. And once you like that, then everything else from there on, I don't want to say is ridiculously easy, but a lot of the work's done. Now you have the challenge of just shooting it or digitally animating it or whatever you need to do. But Aviator was really rewarding because a lot of people didn't realize how much of the shots were, in fact, effects. And not only was there a fair amount of digital work done by Sony Pictures Image Works, but we did a lot of in-camera stuff, really old school, where we had Leonardo DiCaprio in a full-size cockpit mock-up outside at the location with quarter-scale engines outside of the windows. Total in-camera, like split-scale, forced perspective, you know, stuff done in the 1930s kind of approach. There's shots in the movie where the plane kind of taxis overhead of the camera, and you look in the distance and you see cars and people watching, and it's all in camera. It's a quarter-scale model with a cameraman literally laying on his stomach on the tarmac with people just pushing the model over him, with people just far enough in the distance to give the correct perspective and scale. So that to me was probably one of the most rewarding shows. And also, when I read the script before we even got involved, I said, wow, I got to work on this movie. The script is fantastic. And, you know, any Martin Scorsese film to get involved with is a good opportunity because it's going to be something that people remember for years to come. In fact, the end of July, there's a series that the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is doing, and they're doing a screening of The Aviator. It's called Great to be Nominated. It's films that were nominated and had the most nominations of that year, so I'm going to be on a panel with Rob, and that should be kind of cool. But to see it projected is a really great, great deal. Yeah. But it's one of those things where it's the more our philosophy, as I said early on, was to do effects that don't feel like effects, and Aviator was a great excuse to make effects that didn't look like effects. Okay. We also worked on a movie called The Good Shepherd, which was a Robert De Niro directed picture, and it was the same thing. It's like you can't take the audience out of the movies somehow, and not to not to dog effects or to criticize effects in general, but somewhere along the line, effects have become so mainstream and so much in the public eye, they've become their own thing. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's great. I mean, the artistry involved and the talent that's involved is spectacular. But there's a point where people, I think, forgot that effects were really supposed to subsidize a part of the story you just couldn't do for real. And if you look back to old Cecil B. DeMille films, even the silent films from the 20s and prior to that, they used effects because they just couldn't. You couldn't have a full-size Circus Maximus for people to be riding around in chariots. And, you couldn't destroy a real town with a flood. So you did it with miniatures or did it with hanging miniatures or matte paintings or whatever you had at the time. And it was really just something to help tell the story and not, unfortunately, which is what's sort of happening now, replace the story. And I don't want to get up on a soapbox and gripe about it, but I think that the effects really should just be something that helps the characters develop and helps carry them along throughout the picture, as opposed to, well, we need something good here for them. What should happen here? Something should blow up. Like, and I've been in those meetings where people just start throwing ideas out. What can we do that's be really cool? Well, come up with why they would do it. And, how is it going to react? And I find that a lot of the big effects films, while they have unbelievably detailed and beautifully designed sequences and unbelievably well-executed sequences, audiences don't connect with them because they're not connecting with the characters. If somebody ends up falling out of a building and plummeting floor after floor after floor and is scooped up by some flying spaceship, if you care about that character, you're on edge when he's falling. If you don't, then it's just another thing happening. It's like you're watching a video game. And I think that's sort of what's happened is people have lost there's been a little bit of a disconnect because some of these films don't necessarily push the character. Now, I have to say Iron Man was a really great exception to that rule where they did, Robert Downey Jr. and Jon Favreau did such a great job developing the character and making him somebody who you want to like or want to be involved with, that when things do happen to him, then it is more exciting because you want something good or bad in some cases, I guess, to happen to the character, because that's you're going to see a story, not necessarily, as I said, watch a video game.
Right. Well, it's funny, the word photoreal almost becomes obscene lately because you're asked to use that term, get used so often to describe something that could never happen.
Right.
Make that, it doesn't look real photoreal. Well, the object's traveling against gravity and that's what you want. But, I mean, there's all these kind of things that we're being asked to do. So I understand your affinity for things like The Aviator. Where it is. It's that love for that photography.
And you can make things look, you just have to, I think one of the things I see in visual effects now, we're very fortunate that we have a practical effects division. We're fortunate that we can go and build a model and shoot it and then incorporate it into a bigger scene. And a lot of companies don't have that anymore. A lot of companies either sold off the visual effects, their miniature effects departments, or closed them down, or a studio sweeps in and buys up a company and then parcels it all out or closes half of it down. And, one of the things we're really pushing now is, you look at a company like Weta. Weta is a prime example of a company that has all the tools. Now, we're certainly, nowhere near as huge in the 3D department as a company like Weta, but we do have very similar, tools, if not the same sort of structure, where if there needs to be something fabricated to be put in front of camera, they can do that. And then we do the same thing. And I find that a lot of these companies, and as I said, it's nothing disparaging about the companies, it's just when digital effects got to be popular and big and started getting kind of crazy in the early to mid-90s, a lot of the studios looked at practical effects as, oh, that's a thing of the past. Oh, that's like the optical printer. We'll never need to use that again. Now, in their defense, yes. I mean, digital compositing is certainly simpler, and the freedom you have and the ability to fix people's screw-ups is fantastic. But the problem is, because they pushed practical effects into obsolescence, practical effects practitioners sort of disappeared, and they went off to do other things, or they went and started teaching, or they left the film business in general. And so what ends up happening now is so many companies that are doing quote-unquote visual effects really can only do digital effects.
Right.
And to me, that's like going to a car mechanic and saying, well, you fix my car. And they're like, well, I have a screwdriver and a pair of pliers. That's all I have.
Well, what's the old adage? If all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
Yeah, and it's so true. And let me say, I mean, some of the 3D animation, I mean, some of the stuff that I've seen Weta and ILM do and Digital Domain, some of these companies, I mean, beautiful work. It's great. I mean, some of the photo textures are getting better and better, and the animation's getting more real than anything else. But there's still a level of, at least from my perspective, I think visual effects really still need to be every trick in the book to fool the audience. You know, it is misdirection still. And if you put everything into a digital world, while there's so many problems that can be solved with that, there's still sort of a level of artificial, it doesn't necessarily look real. And I'm not saying 100%, there's still stuff that is absolutely amazing. I have to say the CG work in Iron Man was spectacular. I mean, it was the cut from a guy in a suit to the CG character, and it's pretty seamless. I mean, it's done very well. But there is a point where, as a filmmaker, I would rather have the tools at hand and be able to mix it up, because you are really still trying to fool the audience. And I think it also gives you a better sense of reality, not necessarily because it's photoreal, but if you apply visual effects or the approach to visual effects as if you had to do it for real, even if it's all digital, but just try to set your cameras as if they're real, there's a sense of believability. Even though an audience in general is not going to be, you know, knowledgeable about the difference between a camera on sticks or a spider cam or technocrane, they still know if something is so unbelievably photographed that it doesn't look real. There's a sense, they understand that there's something that doesn't look real and they don't know why. And some movies, you know, it doesn't have to look real. It is sort of a fantasy, so, you know, what the heck. And particularly with the competition of video games now with the film business, people tend to, you know, it's sort of a crossover where I guess they don't know. Although I've talked to a number of, you know, today's youth, as you call it, who play a lot of video games, and I say, well, what kind of effects do you like, and what works well for you, and what do you believe? And I am astounded at how many 15- and 14-year-olds will say, well, I really like, I thought Blade Runner had some really great stuff. And I'm shocked. And I say, well, what about? And they say, well, you know, if I want to see a video game, I'll go play a video game. I want to go to the movies and see a movie. And that's not everybody, but I found that surprisingly shocking, that they'll go back to films that are, you know, 15, 20 years old and reference them as effects work.
I think it's so important. I mean, sitting in VES sessions over the years and hearing people talk to Trumbull and just different people of that generation talking about effects and lenses and lighting and the importance of that knowledge base and getting people to, you know, think about those things. That if you do come up in a completely digital world, it's very difficult to have that appreciation and understanding and think about the practical.
And you know, for me, it's not. I mean, we embrace the technology. We're using computers here for everything from planning out miniature shots to doing the finish work. So it's not that, you know, it's not that I feel that there's an answer that is can't, or should say there's a question that can be answered with one answer. But I think that going through effects, it's whatever tool is going to work best for the shot. And because a lot of the effects are primarily digitally driven, you do lose the experience and the knowledge of doing a practical shot. And people don't sometimes understand lenses or lighting or composition. And I have to say, some of the tools available in the digital world, from, you know, something as simple as compositing to even some of the 3D work, you know, you can pre-build a lot of shot work that's pretty elaborate that would have taken, you know, months and months and months, even 5-10 years ago.
Right.
So there's also sort of a quick lead in where if you know the tools, I'll find a lot of people say, well, you know, I'm a digital artist and this is what I do. And I say, well, this is great. You know the tools, but the composition of the shot's terrible, or the lighting's wrong, or the perspective is wrong, and the tools. But to maybe a studio executive, they may not know the difference. They say, well, this guy's really good because he can operate the software. So it really all comes down to, no matter what the tools are, whether it's physical or practical or, you know, miniature, digital, any of that, it still comes down to an eye. You have to have an eye, and you have to be able to really have a good understanding of why a shot works and why it doesn't. The thing I always explain to directors, because they always ask, well, how do you know if it's a miniature and how do you know if it's digital? And, you know, and as I said, the lines are so blurred now, it's really hard to delineate. And a lot of times it comes down to, well, what's cheaper. At least that's how sometimes the studio wants to look at it. But for the most part, it's really the approach to their filmmaking style. If this is someone who came primarily from commercials or say, you know, music videos, where they want to have a completely active camera at all times, they want to have the ability to change the shots forever until the film is released, then I would say, well, you may want to stick to more of a digital approach, because you have this omnipotent camera you can use, and you have the ability to control the shot to the end. But you're going to sometimes sacrifice believability. It may not look real. The audience may be clued in immediately that it's an effect, and, you know, that's something that you have to look at. But if you're somebody who wants to have it much more believable, and feel like it's really happening to the characters, and also is willing to have the camera maybe a little bit limited, then you may want to have a more of a practical and digital mix of an approach. The big thing that people have to understand with practical effects, and I think this is where the digital world has eclipsed a bit of this pre-production time, is with practical effects, you have to plan every single shot. Everything has to be planned, down to where the camera is going to be, what the action of the model is going to do, and you really have to know. I mean, this seems to make sense. You always need a blueprint to do anything, but with the digital work, you can really tweak it and change it. But with practical effects, even if they're just, you know, segmented elements or just pieces of elements, you still have to know what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. Because otherwise, you know, you can't show up on the day and say, oh, you know, I'd really rather shoot it from this angle and I'd rather, you know, light it differently. Well, we kind of planned it for this. The advantage, though, with practical effects is you can throw a couple more cameras on it and get multiple angles and, you know, give you more coverage. It just depends on, depends on the shot.
Right. Well, there's the old, you know, cell animation. They always say, you know, given like a Pixar DreamWorks film type thing would be done now. People have a concept of understanding. A given artist can produce X amount of animation in X amount of time.
Right.
With a miniature shoot, you have an X schedule. But with digital, people tend to kind of get lost in that schedule a little bit.
The schedule
can shrink insanely. It takes as much or more time sometimes to do digitally. You know, depending on what you're doing.
It's true. It's the difference between, I was saying this the other day, it's the difference between, you know, sitting somebody down at a computer with like a Word document and typing up something and then turning around and giving them a manual typewriter. It's like, you better kind of know what you're going to do before you have the manual typewriter, or you're going to have the correction fluid out throughout the whole process. And that's sort of the difference with, you know, the miniatures versus practical. The other thing with practical effects, miniatures versus digital, I should say, practical effects, miniature effects, it's always like, I think it's akin to using, you know, to building a Swiss clock. It always has to work. Everything has to work at a certain time. And you have so many people standing around waiting for this to happen and, you know, sitting there prepping, pre-lighting, pre-rigging, in this case of motion control, pre-programming, and everything has to work at the exact moment. And the pressure is actually, even though I've done a number of pyrotechnic shots over the years, even today, if I had to shoot tomorrow, I would still be on pins and needles before we pull the trigger, because you just never know. And sometimes you get some really great accidents that happen in the shot, and sometimes the shot doesn't really look so good and you got to do it again. And we do a tremendous amount of testing prior to shooting, so that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You got to spend a lot of time on before you get to production. But one of the things we're now kind of pushing more into is the development of product and material, our own productions, so that you have, similar to the studio systems of the 40s or the 30s, you have the ability to generate the entire production under one roof, and that's kind of what we're moving towards. We just co-produced a film which we're targeting probably late September, early October, a movie called 100 Feet that stars Famke Janssen, sort of a supernatural thriller that has effects that we tried to keep down. Actually, we did about 212 or so digital shots, a little bit of practical work, but primarily digital, and tried to keep it in the same vein of how we approach our practical work. And that was a really great experience. Being on the other side of it, on the producing end, is a lot more rewarding in a lot of ways, because you can really, really dictate what can be an effect and what should be an effect more so than anything else. So that was a great experience. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. I also saw on the webpage that you're involved in a photographic project.
Yeah, actually, in fact, a photographer is going to be here in probably next hour or so. There's a young woman by the name of Melanie Pullen who did she's a fine artist, a photographer who did a series called High Fashion Crime Scenes.
Love that.
A little while ago. Yeah, mm-hmm. And she's fantastic.
I had seen that prior to seeing it mentioned in the story, and I just was like, oh, that's who this is.
Yeah, okay. She did a really great show, and then she had her show was put into she produced a book from the show, and we're involved with that. I don't want to say what it is just yet, because it's we're working with all. We're helping her do some of the assembly of it, but we did do a number of miniatures for the sequence, and it's her next show, which I think is coming out in a couple of months. I don't know exactly. That's the one thing about artwork, is that necessary deadlines aren't always what you'd expect them to be. But she's very talented, and it's been a great collaboration, a lot of fun.
That's cool. Get to stretch in a different direction, do something.
Well, that's one of the things that we like to do here. I don't want to specifically just do film or just do television. And the idea of doing something more in the vein of fine art is a lot more appealing in many ways because it's something that's a little bit more permanent. You mentioned League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and I've shown fine artists stills of that work, and they can't even comprehend it. You know, I could take a quarter or an eighth of one of the facades from one of the many buildings we had done and hang it on a wall in a museum, and it's a piece. It's like, oh, well, this is a gallery piece.
Well, walking through the shop, those buildings on the top, what were they from?
Oh, it was a music video we did a number of years ago.
Oh, my God. You know,
but this is stuff we crank out to put in front of a camera, and that's some of the things. So when I had the opportunity, when Melanie had called us about this photographic project, I was excited because I thought, well, this is an opportunity to – not that the film work isn't fun and it's rewarding, but you build it. You throw it in front of a camera, you shoot it, and 9 times out of 10, it gets thrown away at the end of the show. I don't even know what happened to the buildings from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I think last I'd heard they were out in a warehouse in Sunland, and I think that's where they
sort of
reside.
We'll find them on eBay someday.
I hope not. I've never made a dime off of any of this stuff. That's
oh,
always
no.
That's a killer. We worked on we did the movie T3, Terminator 3, and my partner Ian had supervised the effects work for that. And we did a big helicopter crash. It was a lot of fun. And at the end of the show, every single model down to every single little sandbag and everything else had to go back to the production company, understandably. For us, we never sell this stuff. We always just put it on display because we want clients to see some of the work we've done. Well, then I guess the production company either folded or I don't know what happened, but somebody picked it all up at like some fire sale. And then on eBay, here's all of our models getting sold for tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
We're like, wow, that would have been nice.
I don't think the studios have figured that out by now. They've started collecting this stuff because it's got to have value.
You know, they do.
Except then you got to store it and pay for that.
And the model.
Preserve it?
Yeah, exactly. And the models we build are such colossal, they're so colossal in scale. The one thing that was pretty neat, and this is one of the, getting back to the Aviator, one of the nicest things about that show was the real flying boat, the Hughes Hercules, or the nickname is Spruce Goose, is up in a museum called the Evergreen Aviation Museum in McMinnville, Oregon. And it's on display. You can walk through it. It's fantastic. But we had worked very closely with the museum when we were doing the show to get all the reference and data and everything. And a lot of the models we had built were donated to the museum and are actually on display.
Oh, that's so great.
So for me, that was probably one of the biggest highlights of the show, because when do you get a chance to have your work put in a museum? But not just a museum, but a museum with the actual aircraft. So actually, under the wing of the Hercules is our 1/16 scale version of the model, as well as the hangar that we had built, as well as a number of other components, and it's been on display for a few years. So that's kind of nice. Otherwise, for those of you listening to this podcast, a lot of the models and a lot of the pieces from film go into an archival system, which is they're all in these sort of nondescript buildings throughout Hollywood. All of the or mostly Burbank, I think. Most of the studios have these huge warehouses, and it's literally like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's crate after crate and shelving units, and you walk through these facilities, and you'll say, oh, that's the model from, you know, from The Right Stuff, or, oh, there's some stuff from a John Wayne movie. Stuff is archived. A lot of the studios, particularly Warner Brothers, does a really amazing job at archiving this stuff, and they have everything from every film that's of note. So it does get put somewhere, but a lot of times it just gets – nobody ever sees it. It gets shuttered away. But a lot of these places, you know, they're air-conditioned, and they make sure nothing happens to them, but it's a little disappointing because then the general public doesn't get to see it. But the stuff does end up getting, somebody ends up keeping it to some degree. Any of the really, really, really cool stuff that could be desktop, which a lot of it we do is much bigger than that, ends up usually in a producer or director's office, which is a nice compliment too. The worst is where you have to throw stuff out, and we've have to do that all the time because the models end up getting destroyed.
Well, and even historically, I have to imagine so many things were destroyed over the years that people just didn't think there was any use in keeping. Why would you? And
well,
plus you couldn't. I mean, maybe you couldn't. Maybe it had to be destroyed.
But
a lot of stuff gets destroyed.
you look at Paramount, and you know they sold off all the stuff from their Star Trek franchise. I mean, all of it, down to the costumes and props and models and all. And I mean, it's good that they sold it off, so at least it didn't get thrown away. But you'll always hear stories about, you know, back in the day when, you know, oh yeah, I found the submarine from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea in a dumpster or something. Not specifically that, but somebody's always throwing something.
I had a friend who grew up in Burbank in the day and said they used to know what day was trash day at Disney, and they would pull the cells out of Mickey and all sorts of stuff out of the dumpster and just, you know, play with them as kids. Never kept them, just played with them.
Yeah.
You know?
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Okay. Well, thank you very much. This has been great. And
no problem.
People should definitely go check out the newdealstudios.com webpage because there's a lot of information on there, a lot of historical photos and fun photos and information about the company. And we'll post some stuff in the story, too, that we can get from you.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate it. I appreciate you coming down here. And like I said, it was fun. I hope people get something out of it. And the website's fun to look at, if for no other reason that we have embarrassing photos of employees. So that's always good.
Perfect. But, thanks very much.
Great. Thank you.
Well, thanks, guys, for that. Really enjoyed listening to that conversation. Again, I had a great time speaking with Matthew Gratzner at VES last year. Really generous with his time. I especially loved the part where they both realized they'd worked on the same spot, Jeff working in post and, of course, Matthew working on the original footage. So I thought that was fun. As I mentioned before, the new term just announced over at fxphd.com, so be sure to check that out. Class is going to be starting soon, so drop by that website. If you have any questions or comments or suggestions for future podcasts or even about the FX Guide site in general, drop us a line at podcast@fxguide.com, and we'll be sure to get back to you. We love hearing from you guys, and so if you have any suggestions, drop us a line. Well, that's it for this week. For my fellow co-founders of FX Guide, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.